That's on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this bright and sunny Sydney day. It's the 6th of July 2010, and this is Bill Cable from Mediate Now. In the studio with me is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners.
And we've had an interesting week. We're getting used to our new Prime Minister, and there's been a lot in the news. Later in the show, we will be, in view of the pending election, which the smart money seems to be on an election at the end of August. We'll see if that comes to pass, but with the election coming, we're going to be focusing on developments in family law. So today we'll be speaking to Greg Andreasen, who is running the One in Three campaign, which is to do with intimate partner abuse of men, and they've been running workshops, so Greg will be bringing us up to date on that. And we'll also be talking with our regular guru, Sue Price. And Sue is going to tell us about a submission that the Men's Rights Association has recently put to the Australian Law Reform Commission, and in particular Professor Rosalind Croucher. So it'll be interesting to get an update from Sue as to all these recent developments. Just going to a news story, we're going to go overseas to the first one. This is in France, and it's interesting to see that France's parliament has passed a law that makes psychological violence a criminal offence. The new measure means that couples who insult each other repeatedly could be charged and face up to 3 years in prison. French Secretary of State Nadine Morano told the National Assembly it was important to recognise psychological violence in abuse laws. The law defines mental violence as repeated acts that could be constituted by words, including insults or repeated text messages that degrade one's quality of life and cause a change to one's mental or physical state. Those found guilty face up to 3 years in jail and a fine of $109,000. So it's going to be interesting to see how that develops in France and whether this is likely to flow over to other countries such as Australia.
Absolutely.
And Ian, you've got something.
Yeah, well, first off, I think we should extend the sympathies of the program to our former wallaby Brendan Cannon, who accidentally ran over his 15-month-old son in the driveway of his Brisbane home on Sunday, I think. The little boy is in hospital, not in good condition, but he survived. He's got a couple of broken legs, and this actually happened to a friend of mine last year. He accidentally ran over his 3-year-old son. And of course, the horror that caused to the family, and I mean, that's the first time I've actually heard my friend cry was when he told me on the phone what had happened. So our sympathies go out to the Cannon family for this tragedy, and we wish the little boy well and hope that he makes a speedy recovery.
Extraordinary that this is another wallaby hooker, because I think many of us think back to Phil Kearns, who was involved in a similar accident. Fortunately, that had a happy ending, and Phil Kearns' daughter, I think it was.
Yeah, it was a little girl, Phil ran over, yep.
Yeah, she seems to have made a full recovery, so we can only hope that Brendan Cannon's child has the same result.
Well, all you rugby players out there, just be a little bit more careful, I think, that, you know, two rugby players running their kids over in 5 years is too many. And, of course, I'm sure both Brendan Cannon and Phil Kearns will agree with me on that one.
Yes, now there's a concerning development in child support, which we're going to need to follow. There's some new legislation in the Senate. It's due to commence on the 1st of July, but that's subject to the consent from the Governor-General. But the indications are that there's going to be a change such that even where court orders that time be spent with the non-custodial parent, the CSA is going to be able to ignore the court order and go back to the time actually spent with a non-custodial parent, which is definitely a backward step, because it's going to encourage breaches of the order or the orders given by the court. The let out is that CSA gives the paying parent 14 weeks to take legal action against the receiving parent before enforcing whatever care the receiving parent states. Now, the only trouble with that is, has anyone ever, anywhere, ever had a case even registered for hearing within 14 weeks? And how did they come up with this very limited time restraint before they'll do the right thing as far as the time spent with the non-custodial parent? Before the court action can even start, there has to be a certificate from an FRC before proceedings can commence. And I can tell you from personal experience that action alone, getting a certificate from the Family Relationship Centre, can take anywhere up to 6 months, and involve there are so many hurdles in getting that certificate that really the non-custodial parent must only shake his head and wonder what is going on in this place, because that's the first step. Before you can file your application, you must get that certificate, and there are so many... Entry restrictions, there are interviews, there are courses, there are all sorts of things done before you even have the mediation, and then you've got to wait. So 6 months is not at all unreasonable in expecting to get that certificate. So that's not yet active, that law. It's something we're going to monitor. As I say, it's subject to the royal assent. But once that comes into place, that could really have very serious consequences for the non-custodial parent, usually the dads.
Yes, indeed. Shocking stuff.
Now, Ian, you've got another.
Well, I've got a few things here. Actually, there's a lot in the papers. Actually, we might go to this one. Why Generation X women are job weary. This appeared in yesterday's Telegraph. And the article states they were generations ahead when it came to finishing school, but many Generation X women have since dropped out of the workforce, and the lack of family-friendly workplace policies is being blamed. Only 38% of tertiary-qualified Generation X women work full-time, compared with 90% of Generation X men at the same level. So that's 38% of women as opposed to 90% of men. In a study that has tracked a group of people since they left school in 1991, researchers found most of the women ranked their career as their highest priority when they left school. But once in the workforce, the pressure of working long hours, lack of maternity support had taken its toll on the women now in their mid-30s. So, all of this effort that we're putting into educating women, which is a wonderful thing, they're not going out into the workforce, they're not getting the jobs, they're not staying at it, as opposed to the men who are. I mean, this is the kind of problem that we get due to this feminist propaganda that's been foisted upon us in the last 40 years that claims that men and women are equal. We are not equal. We will never be equal. We are equally important, but we have different aptitudes. We have different life paths. And to Julia Gillard, our new Prime Minister, is a classic example. Here is a woman who made a decision early in life not to have children because she wanted to become a politician, which is, a great choice for her, I imagine, although I don't know when she's an old lady sitting around with no children and no grandchildren coming to visit how she's going to feel sitting around looking at the pictures of her on the wall with all her cabinet ministers from the past and all of that. I don't know, but it's a huge sacrifice for a woman to have to make, whereas a man... I mean, you go into the lodge with a family, and of course we've also, Julia Gillard has confessed she doesn't believe in God. Now, I personally would like to know what she does believe in, because there's a lot of Christians, a lot of Muslims, a lot of Buddhists. Our community is a spiritual-based one. Most people have, if we're not affiliated with an organized religion, we at least have a spiritual leaning in some direction. And I, for one, would be very curious as to what Ms. Gillard's spiritual leaning, if indeed she has one, is. I mean, she can't just be totally absorbed in ambition and wanting to get to the top and that's all she ever thinks about. So we've sort of, through getting a woman in power, we have by stealth managed to get somebody into the lodge who doesn't believe in God. This is, I think, is a first. And secondly, doesn't have a family, is not married, is living in a de facto relationship and has no children, which to me, the sacrifices she had to make to get to the top should not be encouraged amongst other women. And there's an article by Bettina Ank.
Hang on, before you go on to that, Ian, maybe just...
Okay, let you have a word in here, Bill.
Well, just on a couple of those things. First of all, we have had some previous prime ministers who've declared themselves not to believe in God, and I'm thinking of Bob Hawke and Gough Whitlam for two.
Both Labor.
Yes, and I don't think that that's... I think, fortunately, these days, that shouldn't be a barrier to being a leader in the country. I think the days when you have to profess some sort of religious affiliation, I mean, I think it's still the case in America, where no one's game to take on the Christian lobby. I think there is an advance in Australia where Julia Gillard can actually say what she believes and not have to pretend that she's a religious believer when she isn't.
But she hasn't said what she believes. She's just said what she doesn't believe, which is the point. I mean, I'd be interested to find out what she does believe. Okay, we know she doesn't believe in God, which I agree with you. That's not necessary. But hang on. To a lot of Christians out there, the very fact that she has stated that means that she is a sinner and she is going to hell, and that we are now, our prime minister, our head of state, is a person who a large proportion of the population believes is not favoured in the sight of God and will be, when she dies, going to hell to be with Satan. That's what they believe. I don't believe this. Well, yes, but you've got to, that's got to have an impact. Mm. You know, you're ruled by somebody who's going to hell. Mm. So all us people who are going to heaven, I mean, we're all good. We all do this. We behave a certain way because we believe that's going to get us to heaven. And here's this person who doesn't have any of that. Mm. And she's the boss. I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, you know.
Well, I guess that can only be reflected when the votes come in. But to date, there doesn't seem to have been any impact, which is probably a good thing that you're not going to be judged on your religious beliefs. But just on the other point you raised earlier too, with the percentage of women in the full-time workforce.
Yep,
the
Generation X women.
Yes, well, I think I've seen figures before that actually the percentage of full-time working women has not changed in 30-odd years, even though you hear a lot about this. The actual figures do not support a great increase in the number of full-time working women. There are a lot of part-time working women, but that full-time working component hasn't changed, whereas the men, of course, are expected to work full-time. And generally speaking, their numbers have not changed either. So it's interesting when you actually get the real figures on those in those areas.
Well, the article goes on to say longer working hours and less job security meant most were not able to establish long-term partnerships, marry and have children as early as the Canadians surveyed. So this, they've done a comparison with Canadians. And in an historic move, Australia will soon have a taxpayer-funded 18-week paid paternal leave due to begin next January. It will bring Australia into line with other leading countries, which they are hoping will keep women in the workforce. I mean, it's a, you know, this is just such an issue of our time, getting women into the workforce. I mean, you know, 50 years ago, the man went to work, the woman stayed at home, looked after the children, and there was enough, he was able to bring home enough money to support the family and buy a home. Now, two people working hell for leather, you know, longer hours at more difficult, stressful jobs, and you can't buy a house anyway. You're still renting, you're working all those hours to rent. I mean, times have changed, you know, and not necessarily for the better in a lot of ways. But can I get onto this Bettina Ant article? Because there's actually a reply to it by Sarah Lamarck-Andon in this morning's Telegraph. So it's quite a, we've got a traditionalist female point of view here, as Bettina Ant represents, and it's answered up by a feminist point of view. So let me just get, this is what Bettina Ant has written in The Age, 29th of June 2010. Shacking up is hard to do. Why Gillard may be leery of the lodge, by Bettina Ant. Julia Gillard doesn't want to move into the lodge until she gets a democratic tick of approval, or so she says. Maybe the real reason she is stalling is to test the waters of public reaction to moving in her first bloke with her. Most media commentators are relaxed about the idea of a de facto first couple. Why not? They say everyone's doing it. What's the big deal about living together? They are right about that fact, cohabitation, what some call marriage light, is changing the social map. Census figures show the proportion of adults in de facto relationships more than doubled between 1986 and 2006, with other countries showing similar shifts. Many social scientists studying this trend conclude marriage light is not a change for the better. It's fine for Gillard, a 48-year-old woman, to live with her bloke. Yet, as a popular role model for women, her lifestyle choice may influence other women into making big mistakes about their lives. Cohabitation produces two groups of losers among women and children. Most women want to have children. Gillard is an exception. And some miss out after wasting their primary reproductive years in a succession of live-in relationships that look hopeful but go nowhere, leaving them childless and partnerless as they hit 40. People often drift into living together. Someone's lease runs out or they get sick of running home for fresh shirts and underwear. They slide rather than decide and frequently fail to discuss their mutual expectations for the relationship. It's the women, who end up stranded when they spend years in a succession of de facto relationships waiting for Mr. Not Ready or Mr. Maybe to make up his mind. Well, we'd argue from the other side. As a man, women can be just as fickle, but... women's tiny reproductive window means they pay a high price for wasting precious breeding time in such uncertain relationships. Well, there you've got to say there is a definite inequality between men and women, because men can have children from the age of 12 or something right through till when we drop dead. So there's a definite inequality there. Bettina Arndt goes on to say, while the de facto lifestyle leads some women to miss out on having children, others are taking the risk of becoming parents despite these unstable relationships. A growing proportion of children is now born to de facto couples, up from less than 3% in 1975 to 12% in 2000, according to data from the Household Income and Labour's Dynamics Survey. It is often assumed these children will provide the glue to keep the de facto relationships together. But sadly... This is not so. David DeVos, a sociology professor from La Trobe University, found cohabiting couples who have children are more likely to break up than married parents, increasing their risk of the negative impacts of family breakdown. If Gillard chooses to play house with Tim Matheson in the lodge, this choice sends a strong message to the huge numbers of women who rightly admire her and seek to follow her example. A lifestyle suited to her particular needs may be riskier for many women and their children. Shall I go on? As a Labour politician, Gillard is hardly likely to spell this out. Her brand of politician is too nervous of offending natural constituents to express concern about lifestyle choices, but it wasn't always like that. And this is really interesting. In 1972, an intriguing discussion between Germaine Diarrhea, as we like to portray her on this program, and Margaret Whitlam was published in the National Times. Whitlam, whose husband had just become new Prime Minister, outspoken a criticism of ex-nuptial births, declaring it was irresponsible to produce children outside of wedlock. When Greer confessed she was considering having a child on her own, Whitlam was forthright. Well, I think that's just a selfish thought. So there you go. Okay, so this is the article, but now in this morning's Telegraph... Sarah Lamarck-Hand has written under the heading Winter Chill Spread Virus of Divorce, because there was another article in this morning's Telegraph saying that divorce seems to be catching, that if your friends divorce, then you're more likely to. If you have a close friend who divorces, you're 73% more likely to get divorced yourself, which is a horrifying thought. But anyway, no one decides to end a marriage on a whim. Here, what do we got? According to Arndt, the new Prime Minister is sending a dangerous message to the young women of Australia in shacking up with her boyfriend. To paraphrase Beyonce, Arndt seems to believe that there's only one way to tackle these things. If you like it, then you have to put a ring on it. And if you don't, then you're just wasting everybody's time. Not even the birth of children can be seen as evidence of a commitment between two children. So you've undertaken a lifelong bond that surpasses all others. Sorry, doesn't count. You need the white dress and chapel to prove you're really serious. Ironically, if these self-appointed defenders of marriage who show such little faith in its resilience as an institution, if the whole till death do us part ritual is really as good as they'd have us all believe, why get into a flap if a few people decide to give it a miss? It's a tradition that survived social revolutions and managed to stay relevant throughout the centuries. It even survived Tiger Woods. Give it a little credit. As for Gillard, no doubt her history-making rise to the role of Prime Minister has inspired young women across the country to contemplate what their own futures might hold. She may have even reminded teenage girls that there are ways to get noticed beyond the pole dancing, faux lesbian kiss antics of Miley Cyrus. So there you go, Bill. I've been reading a lot there. Would you got anything to say about this? This is a feminist defending this point of view. I thought Bettina made a pretty serious argument there on the sacrifices that Julia Gillard had to make, and we've got this person coming into office as our Prime Minister who has made sacrifices, as opposed to, say, Kevin Rudd, who didn't have to make those sacrifices. He went in there with a family. John Howard before him, they went in with a family. They didn't have to sacrifice anything. They were men, and they were basically pursuing a normal career path that required them to have full lives, full spiritual lives, full family lives, and it was through those full lives and the success of them in their lives that they got to the highest position. Gillard, on the other hand, has compromised. She's sacrificed certain things. And we have a stripped-down personality who is now our Prime Minister.
Yes, look, I love Bettina Arndt and her take on a lot of things, and her most recent book, which was about it had to do with the male sexual needs, which was brought home a lot of truths. But in this case,
Only one book. I think you could write several encyclopedias about male sexual needs. I could.
Yeah. So, I've certainly spoken to Bettina Arndt on those topics. But in this case, I think we have to be a bit careful because, in the old days, Billy McMahon was always told that he had to get married before he could ever be considered a prime minister. And I'd like to think we've moved beyond that.
We obviously have.
Yeah, and when we when criticism is made of Julia Gillard for whether she has children or not, I mean, you've got to be very careful because who knows? She may not be able to have children, or maybe her partner is unable to have children. And I don't think she should be criticised.
No, but it says that Julia made a choice early in her career that she was not going to have children, she was not going to have a family, that she was going to put all her eggs in the basket of career, as it were. She's made this statement. So, okay, fair enough what you're saying, but it not relevant in this case. Here is a career woman who made a very specific choice young in life that she was not going to pursue the family option.
I don't actually have any problem with that. It's only, I mean, if she decides she doesn't want to have children, she can still have a fulfilling life. And obviously she has. She's going to have a very fulfilling life. But my problems are when you do have children and then you don't care for them. If you don't have children, well, I think that's really a personal decision and it's up to you. And no one should really criticize you one way or the other. But it will be different. We'll have to get used to the idea of the, I think he's called the first bloke. So
first mate, perhaps we call him our first mate.
Yeah, that sounds good. Turning up for official functions and things. That's going to be interesting. I mean, of course, Julia Gillard has to get through the next election. So this may be a very short-lived thing. But who knows? But for the next couple of months, we'll have to get used to this idea. I think it's interesting that there does seem to be a lot of gloss seems to be coming off Julia Gillard already. If you look at the letters to the editor, so many of them are critical of her. So the usual, although there was a first blush of enthusiasm at having a female prime minister, it seems to me that already the criticisms for in a number of areas, and I guess I'm more concerned about the attitude to the asylum seekers that I think is something we all need to be careful of, and her so-called deal with the miners was, when you examine it, is actually a deal with the three major miners who had all the money. So
basically, she was rolled. That whole deal makes a mockery of our democracy. It goes to show that it doesn't matter what the people want, that big business control everything. If you were listening to my 9:30 blues a couple of hours ago, I specifically covered this topic. That the miners have basically rolled the Prime Minister because the policies didn't suit their greedy, self-serving ways. There's no other way to put it. And they have the power and the ability to get rid of a man who, up until a few months ago, was one of the most popular Australian Prime Ministers in history. And I don't think Kevin Rudd did anything so horrifyingly evil that he, you know, that he should have been impeached. It wasn't a Bill Clinton type event. He wasn't running off with the secretaries or something. You know, he was a good man doing his best at a very difficult job representing the people who elected him to do what he was doing. And to have him rolled in a backroom deal by a bunch of invisible anonymous, and it turns out industry heavyweights, I think is quite frightening and horrifying. Is something that all Australia, and the fact that we've had this person come in by stealth, this stripped down personality, and I've got nothing against Julia Gillard, don't get me wrong, I like her, I think she's a damn fine Sheila, she's a great chick, and good on you, Julia, you're doing great work. But let's just back off the personality side and let's just have an analysis here of what has actually happened. And of course, the assault on the institution of marriage, I think, which is already under great attack, which is the basis of our society, which is the way that we provide stable environments to bring up our children. This is under attack. And the consequences are obvious. We spend most of our shows documenting the consequences of the breakdown of family. And it's not a good thing. So this has got to be seen as another blow at the foundation stones of our civilization.
Well, look, we've extended our time on all this political talk. We might go to a break, and we'll be back shortly with Greg Andreasen.
Why does my heart so bad? Why does my soul feel so bad? Why does my heart feel so bad? Why does my soul
so Why does my soul feel so bad?
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air, this 6th day of July, 2010. And our next guest is Greg Andresen, who is responsible for the 1 in 3 website. Greg, are you there?
I am, Bill. How are you going?
Well, thank you. Now, Greg, you've been running workshops on intimate partner abuse of men, and I think these form part of your podcast. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit more about it. I know, I think you spoke to Greg Deer last week, or Dr. Greg Deer.
That's right, yeah. As regular listeners would know, we played an interview with Dr. Greg Deer a week or two ago on the show, and that he was one of the researchers, one of the three researchers from Edith Cowan University in Western Australia who have conducted quite a large study into intimate partner abuse of men over the past year or so. They've been working on that, and that was finally released a month or 6 weeks ago in Perth, and has drawn a fair bit of attention from the media and from people working in the field, in the sector. And as part of that launch, the organisation that commissioned the research, which is the Men's Advisory Network in Perth, I believe you spoke to Gary Bryant from that organisation. MAN is the yes. acronym.
Yes, we did.
A few weeks back.
That was just before it was officially released, I believe, and it was very interesting talking to Gary about that.
Yeah, so MAN organised a one-day workshop in Perth for service providers in the sector. So this is anyone who may be called upon to provide services to help male victims of domestic violence. So, and it was very well attended. There were probably about 80 people there when it came. I flew across from Sydney for that. And so the kind of people there were people from police, corrective services, counselling, accommodation, shelters, phone support, basically anyone who might be, might have a guy come up to them and say, look, I need help. I'm being, abused in my relationship. And it was a really good turnout. And I can't imagine, 5 or 10 years ago, having so many people turn out saying, yes, we accept that, this is an issue for some men and that we want to attend a workshop so that our service is, really aware of all the issues that men may face and the reluctance that men may have in actually walking into my office and, admitting they've got a problem and seeking help for it. So it was really exciting.
So were people passing on the stories of their experiences, or was it designed to get the knowledge out there? What was the aim of the workshop?
Well, it started off with presentations by the researchers from Edith Cowan University who conducted the study. They basically, and these are all available actually as audio recordings, MP3s, and also as transcripts if you prefer to read them. On the 1 in 3 new podcast, which is the if you go just to 1in3.com.au/podcast, you'll get there. So if you want to listen to them, then go there. But so the presentations were basically talking about the research, and so Dr. Greg Deer was there, and also Emily Tilbrook, she was the researcher, actually sat down with the men and interviewed them and about their experiences. They basically outlined the how the study worked, what they found, what the findings were of the study, what the recommendations were. So that basically briefed everyone on the study, and then there was a question and answer session, which was really useful, so that people from the floor could actually ask the researchers, about any questions that they had about any holes that they may have seen in the research. And so, you know, a few things came up, like questions were asked about the statistical reliability of the study, because it was a small sample. There were only, I think, 26 people interviewed, and people felt, well, you know, how can you say it's a representative study with a small sample size? And so the researchers were able to defend the fact that it was a qualitative study, and that qualitative studies never have large sample sizes. In fact, many qualitative studies, for example, of female victims of domestic violence might have sample sizes of 8 or 10 or 12 people. And it's different to a quantitative study. So a qualitative study, basically, you interview people and find all the different themes you can about what people may be experiencing, and you only need a small sample size to unearth all of the different themes before you actually find that each successive interview is coming up with the same theme. So there's no point in interviewing 200 people if you interview 20 and all 20 of them are coming up with the same issues. Then it's a completely valid study, and it's not designed to be statistically representative. And so, but the second part of the study, which was a online survey of service providers around Australia, actually surveyed some hundreds of service providers, and that was actually a very good representation statistically of the service providers that were out there. And so it was actually able to draw some findings that were statistically valid about the issue. So it was good for the researchers to be able to defend the research. Another woman stood up and said, well, you know, there's the one thing that's missing from the men's stories is the experience of this ongoing terror and fear of disclosing, for the fear that their partner may, you know, really abuse them. And so the researchers were able to say, well, actually, you know, a number of the men did experience this and did tell this to us, and these are the areas in which we found that experience from the men. So it was good for the researchers to be able to defend the research and answer questions. Then the second part of the day was actually more of a workshop where we were broken up into groups of, you know, tables of 8 people and able to actually discuss issues that we may have in our own areas. So, you know, I was there sitting next to a woman who runs the inmate support for a maximum security men's prison, and she's a big sort of tough woman. And and she's talking about, you know, the guys in there, and a lot of them have experienced, domestic violence, and a lot of them are actually perpetrators as well, and of course. But, you know, she's talking about the issues that they have, you know, in her context, and, you know, there are other people there from counselling services. And so that was an opportunity to really sort of share some stories of different guys that that may have come in, and sort of issues that they may have had. So
yes, well, you've got broad experience in this area, but did you get any surprises from any of the presentations?
No, I think, you know, I worked in this area for many years now, so nothing really surprised me. One area that brought some surprise, not from me but from others, was that Relationships Australia, which is, as you probably know, is the largest, one of the largest counselling and support services nationwide around relationships, and obviously does a lot of work in the area of relationship violence and abuse and respectful relationships and communication, all of that sort of stuff. The Western Australian branch of Relationships Australia told their entire staff that they were not allowed to attend this workshop.
Good heavens.
So the ideological standpoint of Relationships Australia in WA, which is that, you know, men can't be victims, and if men say they're victims, they're really the perpetrators, you know, this old feminist claptrap, is still alive and well. And there were actually a couple of people, workers for Relationships Australia, who did attend, but more or less anonymously. They were sitting there saying, well, I can't say where I'm from, but everyone knew where they were from, but they didn't want to be disciplined. And anyway, when this came out and we were actually discussing it, lots of the other service providers were astonished and really surprised to hear that Relationships Australia, who they thought was a fairly progressive organisation, was forbidding their members from attending this workshop. And it's just mind-boggling, the sort of stuff that goes on. There's still this highly politicised feminist stance out there. It's like the feminists have been sort of backed into a corner and they've put up the barricades and they've got their rifles out and they're not going to give up, you know. It's sort of like holding on tooth and nail. And when no one's saying that, you know, we should stop supporting abused women, we're just saying that we need to support abused men as well.
Well, I have my own story about Relationships Australia that for a mediator to get a position with Relationships Australia in an FRC, you have to subscribe to the Jen McIntosh view of the world. She's the patron saint of Relationships Australia, and if you dare to say that you have question marks over things such as attachment theory, you can forget about working at a Relationships Australia, which is not the true spirit of academic research. Jen McIntosh being an academic, but that's an extraordinary organisation, and that is even more extraordinary that they weren't allowed to attend the seminar.
Yeah, and the head of Relationships Australia in WA actually published an editorial in the main West Australian newspaper over there, basically attacking this research and saying, oh, you know, yes, oh, we know that maybe there are some men who are victims, but we all know that female victims are much more likely to be injured and female victims are much less likely to report it. And when women hit men, it's in self-defense. So if these men have been hit by women, they must have been attacking the women first. And these old discredited feminist furfies, but it got an airing, and a lot of people would have read that and actually bought the lies. I mean, if people are interested in the real statistics on this issue, go to the 1 in 3 website, 1in3.com.au, and /FAQS, which is frequently asked questions, and there's a whole lot of research there about those sort of furfies, which have really been discredited, the idea that, you know, women are only violent in self-defence, etc.
We do often refer people to that because it is where you get the real facts and the real research, and it's a fantastic resort to have that available, the 1in3 website. And I think you've mentioned before you can go either to the words or the numbers, and you'll go to the same site.
Yeah, that's right. It's 1in3.com.au, either words or numbers, and that'll get you to the website. So it's not just I'm the webmaster, so I'm involved in a day-to-day sense with the campaign, but it's not just me who's behind it. There's a coalition of many concerned individuals and activists and practitioners. A lot of them are counsellors who work in the area of relationship abuse, and they just, you know, couldn't go on any longer subscribing to the feminist model of domestic violence because, you know, they have women walking in the door who are clearly, you know, say to them, you know, I need help for my, you know, my violence and my abuse. I'm abusing my partner. And men that walk in the door saying, you know, my wife's, you know, showing them the burn scars from their wife when she poured the hot water over them. And, you know, this is that. So there's a whole group of us who are involved in the campaign and involved in doing the press releases and other activities. So, which is really great because, you know, these are the people who are going to change the paradigm around this issue and really bring it out in the open that, you know, both men and women can be violent and abusive, and the real victims in all of this are the children. It doesn't matter if it's mum or dad or both who are violent. If a child's growing up in a household where violence is a way to solve your issues, there's serious impacts on them in terms of their health and well-being, their educational outcomes, and of course, their future use or potential use of violence when they grow up and enter relationships.
Yes, I mean, it's a fundamental failing of campaigns like the White Ribbon campaign that is directed solely at men against women. They forget about women against men, men against men, men against children, women against children. There are a whole range of scenarios which are equally bad, aren't they?
Absolutely. And look, it's not just some people say, oh, one in three, they're just cherry picking their statistics from here and there. And I mean, every single survey which actually asks both men and women about their experience of violence, every single one, without exception. And the problem is that there's lots of surveys which only ever interview women, and of course they don't find any male victims, but everyone that talks to both men and women finds that at least one in three, and sometimes as many as one in two, victims are men. I mean, you'll all be aware that the Australian Institute of Family Studies did a large report commissioned by the Attorney General into the impact of the family law reforms in 2006. And that huge study was published in December last year, and that talked to about 5,000 men and about 5,000 women who had been through the family law system under the new legislation over the past 3 or 4 years. And it's found that 40% of victims of physical violence were men, and 50% of victims of emotional abuse were men. So this is the largest, most respected body on researching these sort of issues, the Australian Institute of Family Studies, certainly respected by government and academia. And it's found that between 40 and 50% of victims of relationship abuse going through the family law system are males. So it's an issue that can't be ignored and can't be shoved under the carpet. And, the feminists can scream loud and from the rooftop, oh, it's 95% men, 95%. But I think the emperors have been shown to have no clothes now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only a matter of time before governments follow suit. Unfortunately, we still have Tanya Plibersek screaming from the rooftops that it's, it's still men abusing women. But,
It's extraordinary the levels of government, and they come out with these statistics false statistics that sound right. Like, you hear things like 2/3 of women have been assaulted, and, extraordinary things with absolutely no backing.
It's astonishing, and it's so irresponsible too, because when they survey men and women about their fear or apprehension of violence, then you find that women experience much higher levels of fear and apprehension of violence than do men. And I think a big part of that, I mean, some of that is just gender differences, in that women are a little bit probably more sensitive just because of their socialisation and maybe even biology than men. But a big part of that is the fact that we have White Ribbon Day in governments and putting out this misinformation saying that you as a woman, there's a 66% chance that you're going to be beaten up by your partner.
Yes.
Of course that instills fear in these women. Irresponsible.
Yeah, it's right. I mean, it's almost a campaign to make women feel insecure and perhaps need, maybe it's a reverse thing, they'll need the protection of men or something. Who knows what the thinking is?
Yeah, look, it's very strange, but it's, it's a fight we're in for the long haul, and myself and my colleagues at 1 in 3 feel it's going to be a 5, 10, 15-year campaign until this issue is really balanced, because the data on this that's showing that men form up a large percentage of victims has been out for decades. It's just that governments and NGOs and the UN and White Ribbon Day, etc., are really just clinging to outmoded feminist beliefs on this and just refuse to accept the overwhelming data that's out there on this issue. So we just need to keep plugging away and good on you guys at Dad's on the Air for addressing this issue on a regular basis as well. It's really, you know, the more we get it out there, we know we're having success because the most recent survey of community attitudes to violence found that, I think it was over a 10-year gap, the number of people who believed that men and women were equally likely to commit domestic violence jumped from something like 8% to something like 30%. Mm. So we now have 1 in 3 people in Australia actually, believing that men and women can both be violent. And I think that's fantastic because it means that the more people who actually believe that both men and women can be violent in relationships, the more likely it is for a man or a woman who actually comes up and says, look, my partner's abusing me, I need some help, whether that's from a service provider or police or just a family member or a friend, they're not going to be laughed at. You know, they're going to be believed and taken seriously. So, and that's what we really want, is that when people come forward, that they actually are taken seriously and receive the support that they need.
Yeah, look, on that positive note, we might have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Greg Andreessen from 1 in 3. You can find that website, 1 in 3 words or figures, put the 1in3.com.au, but if you put 1 in 3 in your search, I'm sure it'll come up with the site. And there's a whole lot of information there. There are podcasts available. And Greg, thank you very much again for coming on the show, and all the best in your campaign, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Absolutely, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Greg.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 6th day of July 2010. And just further to that discussion with Greg Andreessen from the 1 in 3 site, there was a story in The Australian on the 7th of June, which is very, very disturbing. This is a case in Victoria where on the 4th of March 2006, a woman by the name of Claire Margaret MacDonald burst into tears as she told the Victorian Supreme Court jury when she was told that they'd found her not guilty of the execution-style murder of her husband, Warren John MacDonald. In this case, the court was told that MacDonald had donned camouflage gear and lay in wait with a high-powered rifle for her husband to approach. She fired 6 shots, mortally wounding her husband, and she successfully used the battered woman.
That was the one that was, they had some argument about potatoes or something the night before. Was that one? I remember
I'm not sure.
When we covered it. That was a couple of years ago. Anyway, sorry, yeah. I digress. Go on.
The concern about this story, and probably the potato story, if it's another one, is that it then encourages other people, so that in another case there was a woman by the name of a friend of this woman whose name was Ms. Fall, who wanted to get rid of her husband, Mr. Falls, who was an age 41, and this was in Caloundra. So it was very well planned. She arranged a meal for her husband and a meal that she knew her children would not be interested in. It was curried prawns, laced it with all sorts of sleeping tablets. And when he came home, fell asleep in his recliner, she walked up to him, placed the pistol against his temple and fired. She told the court she could see the burn mark and the smoke coming from the hole in his head. She waited 2 hours and, not sure whether her husband was dead, placed the pistol under his jaw, fired another shot. And then after leaving the body in the house for 3 days, she called on her friend and 2 other accomplices to help her clean the crime scene and dispose of the body. The body was later retrieved from dense bushland in the Mapleton State Forest. Mr. Falls was described as his family as a good all-round person. He was a happy bloke, liked a drink and a laugh. But when his wife decided that she was going to kill him and facing
she had court, enough.
She had enough.
She had enough. That was it.
And there was some question of violence, but it had stopped before their not so much violence, abuse actually. But it had stopped some years before this. But the judge, in instructing the jury, Judge Justice Applegarth, told jurors that the defence lawyers did not have to prove that she was acting in self-defence when she shot and killed him, but rather the prosecution must prove she wasn't acting in self-defence at the time. So, following the judge's summing up and a few tears, no doubt, from Ms. Falls, she was found not guilty of murder and also not guilty of the lesser charge of manslaughter.
Not guilty of anything?
Nope.
She's fine. You're allowed to shoot your husband because you say he's a bad man, so that gives you a right to kill him.
It's a license to kill, and her accomplices were also found not guilty of the charge of accessory to murder. Well, if there was no murder charge, you can't be an accessory, I guess. And, the question remains, why didn't she just go to the family court?
What about the man's dead body with a couple of bullet holes in it? I mean, doesn't that constitute evidence?
I think evidence? This case would indicate you don't have to hide the body. You just call the police and claim self-defense.
He abused me. He called me a bad mother or a cow or something, so I had to shoot him. I had no. Well, Bill, you went to law school. The maxims of equity, justice must be seen to be done. I mean, don't these judges go to law school? I mean, I remember that from 30 years ago. Justice must be seen to be done. How can you, somebody who's obviously murdered somebody, cold-blooded, premeditated murder, that's what we've just heard about then, that's what I heard. Justice must be seen to be done. How can they do this? Oh, it's only murder if you're a man. Only men can murder people. Women can't murder people.
It's quite extraordinary. I think this violence campaign has just gone way too far, and that's why we say more power to Greg Andreessen and his group. Yeah. That the one in three site that we actually get the facts and figures out there. And so we're talking about.
They've modified the tenth or the whatever commandment it is. Thou shalt not murder unless you're a woman. Then it's fine.
Fifth commandment from
fifth, is it?
Thou shalt not kill. Anyway, yes.
Unless you're a woman. It's been modified by the Australian judicial system. We won't say justice system because that's a misnomer.
Yeah. Well, we might go to a short break, and hopefully we'll be back with Sue Price shortly. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air, and our next guest is our regular contributor from Queensland, from the Men's Rights Agency, and we're talking with Sue Price. Are you there, Sue?
Morning, Bill.
Good morning. Sue, we've had a bit of a discussion already this morning, but we're coming up to an election. It may be the end of August, as soon as that.
Wow. Gillard's trying to make tracks whilst she thinks she's popular.
Yes, I think that's probably a good move on her part. But do you think we might get a bit more traction with the election in the air?
You might get a few promises, but I doubt whether the Labor Party is going to change its original opinion, which is they really don't care.
Mm.
As far as I can see, the only thing they're worried about is how to improve issues for women.
Mm.
Not that I don't see that women's situation shouldn't be improved, but so should men's and so should children's.
And is that perhaps underlined for the Greens? What do you think the Greens
are? Well, if you vote for Greens, you're voting for Labor, aren't you, really? I've always sort of regarded them as being a substitute Labor party, and their preferences usually go to Labor, so you might as well vote for Labor.
Mm. I felt when the 2006 changes were going through under the Howard government, that the Greens seemed to be strongly against them, even more so than the Labor.
Well, neither Labor nor the Greens have come out as being particularly family friendly in any shape or form. So I think you've got to be very suspicious of what they might say to you pre-election and to what they might do post-election. And that's what really worries me with Labor. We got the word that after McClellan launched, the Attorney General launched all those inquiries, six inquiries, Kevin Rudd had sort of said, ease up, we don't want this to become an issue before the election. But what happens after the election really does concern me and does worry me if Labor are successful in retaining power.
Yes, because it does seem to have gone off the boil, all those mooted changes, but you think they might be just drawing their breath until after the election?
I think they've got their information. The girls have been very busy behind the scenes, and we're now facing a considerable rolling back of the shared parenting laws. Probably the first part that they will tackle will be the removal of penalties if someone is making false allegations. That's been in there for the first time in any substantive move, but now I think they'll roll that back.
That's
and that, of course, was a primary consideration to stop all the false allegations and hopefully allow fathers to get good contact with their children.
So even though we know about core promises and non-core promises and all the rest of them, it probably would be a good idea to put some of these candidates on the spot and ask them what their position is.
Yeah, I think we should be doing that with each of them individually, because we won't get the answers straight out from them unless we do that. And at least if they get in afterwards, we can then sort of say, well, this is what you said prior to the election. What's changed?
Mm. Yes.
But I think, I think all of them, all politicians need to be reminded about, the 1 in 3 campaign. They need to be reminded about our campaign that we've had running with the postcards, talking about who's actually committing the violence against children, the abuse of children, about domestic violence issues and about shared parenting, the benefits of shared parenting. And that's what everybody out there who's got an interest in family law, family separation, needs to be doing. They need to make an appointment with their politician, their federal politician, go and see them and say, these are my views. What are you going to do to support my views?
Yes. Usual story of getting people motivated.
It can be difficult, Bill, but we keep trying. And I think I read quite a lot of interest in the forthcoming election. As you know, we've had a survey running about whether people would vote Labor if they thought that they were going to roll back shared parenting. And strangely enough, the minute that Gillard got the prime ministership, we had an unprecedented a number of people replying to the survey, all saying that they won't vote for Labor.
That's interesting.
So maybe they fear Gillard more than Rudd, and I think that's probably a justifiable fear.
Yes, I have seen some references about her attitude. Has she really come out on the question of families and parents and fathers in the past that you're aware of?
I don't think she said anything positive as far as parents and fathers. That's my view of it. And if she wants to do that, of course, she's more than welcome to come out and tell us that she fully supports families and will fully support fathers and their shared parenting role in with if they do become separated. But I haven't seen any signs of that.
No. And so you've recently put a submission into the Australian Law Reform Commission. It wasn't exactly what they asked, but it was a paper that prepared for another study, I believe.
They asked... it was one of the studies that McClellan sort of initiated, and he asked the Australian Law Reform Commission to make inquiries about the relationship of the domestic violence laws around each state and the Family Law Act and how they interact. But the trouble was, with this consultation, they were given the job, and I think it was in May in 2009, and they consulted with all the people who are virulently opposed to fathers anyway, and they consulted with a lot of judges and people in those sort of positions, but they didn't consult with one fathers group or men's group at all until they actually released their document, which is 1,000 pages of recommendations that they were putting forward. They then gave us 34 days to respond. Well, I can't respond to a document of that size in 34 days, and I decided and put it to our people, and they've all supported me on it, that we really shouldn't be participating in such blatantly discriminatory inquiries in the first place. Because if we do participate, we're virtually giving them credence for them to go forward and say, oh, we have consulted widely, when we know that they haven't.
That's right. I mean, the Men's Rights Agency will be listed, and people will assume that their views have been taken into account, which are not necessarily the case.
That's right. I sent a follow-up letter to Professor Croucher, and I said, as I mentioned, we'd already decided to boycott the inquiry because it is blatantly discriminatory towards men and their children. We did not come to this decision lightly, but after observing the methods employed by various government and quasi-government bodies to inquire into family, legal and social policy issues, it seems pointless to continue participating in processes that are designed to come to a predetermined conclusion. We've also concluded that not only is there no point, but by contributing to such inquiries, we are in fact enabling those charged with conducting them to claim they have consulted widely with all interested parties if we do participate. So we took the point of view that we weren't going to participate, but we were going to boycott their consultation, their inquiry, and I think that's what a lot of other people should be doing and telling them so, because they are blatantly biased.
Yes.
Whilst doing some research on it, I was quite surprised to... I went back to the Hansard records because there was an inquiry into the Australian Law Reform Commission in 1996, and the Commission, they say, the independence and objectivity of the Commission is founded in part by its statutory nature and in part in the independent management and operations of the Commission. There is no power for the Attorney General to be involved in the formulation of reports and recommendations, nor is there a power for the Attorney General to direct the Commission in connection with the performance of its functions or exercise of its powers. But everyone who's written to the Australian Law Reform complaining about the bias shown in their inquiry has been told, oh, we can't do anything about it, it's what the Attorney General has set down for us to inquire into.
Yes.
So someone is not telling us the truth.
Yes, well, yes, either not telling the truth, it's hard to know. I mean, I was at a conference with the Attorney General a couple of weeks ago, the Lone Fathers Association conference.
Right, yes.
And Mr. McClellan was there, and I put it to him, the age-old question about perjury in the family court. And he did a backflip and said, oh, this is for the family court to decide. It's nothing to do with me. I'm not going to get involved with the separation of powers. You know, I'm government, the courts, it's a court matter, blah, blah, blah. And then, interestingly, later on, the acting chief judge of the family court, when he had his turn at the microphone, said that was completely wrong and that perjury necessarily is in the domain of the Commonwealth Attorney General, which was quite interesting.
Well, that's what we've always understood, that it's the Attorney General and the Director of Public Prosecution, but nobody has actually decided to prosecute in those cases. You know, with the excuse, oh, well, you know, it's in a separation, people don't really understand what they're saying, you know, they make mistakes, et cetera, et cetera. But perjury is perjury.
Yes, and
such.
He seems to be under the misapprehension that it's someone else's problem, but it is firmly in his area that he has to take responsibility for perjury in the family court. I mean, it'd be a full-time job checking the perjury in the family court. I think you go down there any day of the week.
Maybe that's the thing, they don't want to open the floodgates on it, but I think they have to, because we have to say to people, if you're going to tell lies to the court, that is wrong and you're going to be punished for it. That's what our justice system is based on.
Yes, it brings down the whole system, really. I mean, I think the family court is a very strange court in many ways, but if it wants to be called a court, it has to have its testimony taken seriously.
Most certainly. The other issue I discovered about McClellan when he was, or he is a member of Barton, but in 1996, he also said, when he was talking about this Australian Law Reform Commission, and we need to remind him of this frequently, he said, firstly, all Australians should have equality before the law. Mm-hmm. Secondly, regardless of their place of residence, should have similar rights and privileges. And thirdly, Australians should have equal access to legal services. Now, Bill, where can you start on that statement?
You wouldn't know where to start, would you?
Well, it's wonderful, isn't it? Equality before the law. So why are they considering changing the domestic violence legislation? Why are they considering putting laws in place that are going to favour women over men? Mm. Why do they not provide adequate legal aid for men and women going through family court? Because they don't. You know, like if mum gets in first, that's it. The father won't get legal aid because legal aid consider it a conflict of interest. So, you know, there are lots of things in that very statement that he seems to have forgotten since he's become the Attorney General.
Yes, well, I seem to remember the Labor government saying that they're going to make decisions based on facts.
Yeah.
Which, I'd refer them to the One in Three
fact
website.
Number one, they can't remember what they said a few years before.
That's right.
So I think that's what we need to be reminding them of. And I think, in actual fact, we need to start a boycott movement. We need to start boycotting their systems and boycotting these inquiries, because the inquiries... The inquiries are only held to justify the position that they want to take.
Mm. It's like they used to say, they talk about barristers, they're saying you never ask a question unless you already know the answer. And it seems to me these inquiries are just, backing up what they want to do anyway.
Yeah, politicians don't initiate an inquiry unless they know they're going to get the answer they're looking for.
Yes.
I think that's quite true.
And then they go to their funded groups and, surprise, surprise, the funded groups say what they want to...
Well, their funding depends on it, doesn't it? And that's one of the greatest problems, that we have very little in independent thought or independent inquiry in this country, because they're all dependent on getting funding from the government. Apart from, I must say, Men's Rights Agency, we are independent.
Yes.
We don't get government funding, and I wouldn't take it if it was offered.
Yes, and that gives you that very free voice, Sue, and makes it all the more valuable.
Yeah. Well, I think it's important we maintain that position as well.
And as long as you can continue. So just a word to all our listeners, it's time to pay your dues to the Men's Rights Agency.
Oh, yeah, it's that time of year again, isn't it?
It is that time of year, and for that very small fee to the Men's Rights Agency, an annual fee, you can...
$40.
$40. You don't need to look very far to see the value you get out of that. So I'd encourage everybody to get their fees paid as soon as possible.
Thank you, Bill. I didn't expect to have a free promotion on Dad's on the air, but it's much appreciated.
No, it's such a good cause. But so just coming back to the submission, I believe you submitted to the Australian Law Reform Commission the submission you'd made to the Chisholm Inquiry.
Yeah, I was sort of talked into that, but I said I would submit it, and I gave them just the submission, just as it was when I gave it to the Chisholm Inquiry. I certainly wasn't going to make any effort to change it or amend it to suit their inquiry format, and they can take it for what they make out of it. And Rosalind Croucher, Professor Croucher, did respond to me and sort of said, thank you very much for my forthright opinion, and they welcomed it. So I think it was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek.
Mm.
But the other thing that happened during the month as well, we got an article published in the Centre for Independent Studies, which was from Murphy to Howard's Law, talking about the changes from when Lionel Murphy brought in the Family Law Act to what happened with the Howard changes and the fears that we have that Labor are going to roll them back, and how it all came about. I think if people can get hold of that article, it's in their policy magazine, they will find a lot of useful information and a lot of references made to research that's been conducted, people who've been conducting the research.
And can they get that from your website, Sue?
No, it's not up on the website yet. I can't put it up there until the Centre for Independent Studies put it up on their website.
Mm.
But that should be in about 2 months, I think.
Okay. Something to look out for. So anything else bubbling away there that you'd like to mention?
Well, we're just extremely busy trying to keep people together, I suppose, with child support. We seem to have an ever-increasing number of inquiries about child support, and decision-making in the child support agency really hasn't improved. That one thing that they have done, they have passed some new legislation just last week, and one of the things that they have done, when you provided an estimate previously, it used to be covered over 15 months. Now they've brought it back to 12 months,
yes,
which helps avoid the double dipping that was taking place by child support. This is an issue we raised 2 years ago, 2007, 3 years ago, with the child support agency, and the answer that we received, Family and Community Services are looking into it. Well, it's only taken them 3 years to resolve the problem.
Yes,
things don't move very quickly, I'm afraid, in government circles.
No, I mean, it's extraordinary that it's taken them all that time, and they're now, you know, crowing about the fact that they've taken such an obvious common sense thing to do to coordinate Centrelink and CSA.
That's right, and you can go to either one now and have it set as to, you know, whether it's a daytime hourly rate, because you might not see your children at night or not as much, or you can do it on the overnight rate, the same as Centrelink, same as child support. Sorry,
yeah.
But there were some other changes as well that that I heard on the email list. There was some consternation about the fact that that child support agency was going to be able to decide either on a legal agreement, like a court order, or on an actual care arrangement, so that if someone might have a court order, child support could say, oh no, but the actual care is different to the court order, and they would take the actual care.
Yes.
People seem to think that that's only a new innovation. That's been going on for years. So it's just been sitting there quietly behind the scenes, and they've been making those decisions themselves, which is, as people say, it is overturning a court order. But they won't recognise a court order unless people say, well, if the other party is breaching the orders, you're going to take them in for a contravention. So you have to be actually showing child support that you're doing something to maintain the existence of the court order as it is.
And I think we were talking about this a bit earlier. There's a time limit too, isn't there, before you have to take this legal action?
Yes, they brought a time limit in 14 weeks too. But I think it's not so much even the fact of having a hearing within the 14 weeks. It's the fact of having lodged your application. And that most people should be able to do that, because if someone's contravening the orders, you give them two or three instances, and that's it. You put them into court for a contravention. Don't delay it. It's absolutely silly to delay it.
Yes, I mean, there is that risk that you may be up for costs if the contravention is not found, but nevertheless, no one else is going to enforce the court order, so you've got to do it yourself.
Well, you have to do it yourself, and I think once, you know, you may have to go through two or three contraventions before you actually get a significant response from the court. Like, as you know, Bill, they have a three-step process where they can sort of order counselling, then they can order a fine. Then they might even send you to jail, though the family court seems to be pretty good at overturning those decisions. But that was the process that was put into place legislatively.
So overall, you're not overly concerned about these changes that, I think they're still waiting royal assent, but they're due to come in on the 1st of July. No major concerns in there?
I don't see a great deal of major concern. I missed, unfortunately, a meeting where they had their explanations. I couldn't make it, but I've got a whole heap of paperwork from them, which I'm going to go through and have a look at it, and I'll let you know if there's any particular considerations. Child support often does things differently when it comes to legislation. They tend to work on a policy basis for changes that they want to initiate, and they will perhaps put them through as regulations, which go through, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning through Parliament without anyone questioning or anything like that. When they establish it as a working base, like this recognition of a court order or recognition of actual care, once that is taken as a given, then they'll put it into legislation and get it accepted that way.
Yeah.
And that's what's probably happened in this case.
Well, Sue, we're running out of time. As always, it's a delight talking to you.
Lovely to talk to you.
So thank you very much again for coming on the program. And we've been talking to Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. And you can go to their website, MRA. If you type in MRA, it'll get it on your Google search, I'm sure, or Men's Rights Agency.
Men's Rights Agency, comes up as.
And you can get access to plenty of good information. And as I say, there's you are able to join as a member of Men's Rights Agency. So, yes, once again, Sue, thanks again. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Sue. Bye.
Bye-bye.
In Distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Back for the last time. We've run out of time again this Tuesday. I'd like to say a special thank you to our guests, Greg Andreessen and Sue Price. And don't forget, you can listen to this show on www.dadsontheair.net. That should be available in the next 24 hours or so. And in the meantime, don't forget, stay listening for Country On with Country Bob. But until next week, it's goodbye from me, Bill Cable.
And it's goodbye from me, Ian Purdy.
See you all next week.
Yeah, have a productive, happy week, everybody.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We dance, we dance.